Hello, hello, everyone. Welcome to Safe Space, the ABA podcast. I'm your host, Michelle Zeman. Be sure to take a listen to our free code words so that way we can give you free CEUs. I am really excited to be doing this interview in particular. She is a neurodivergent BCBA like myself, but she is also an SLP too. And today we're going to be talking a little bit about Gestalt learning or Gestalt language processing. So please welcome Carly Donnelly, SLP BCBA, to the podcast. Welcome, Carly.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm super excited to be talking with you today because, number one, as a neurodivergent BCBA, I really don't get to talk to other neurodivergent BCBAs. And number two, I've been learning a little bit more about Gestalt language processing and kind of how, like, I myself am a little bit of a Gestalt language processor. So it's really cool to be able to talk about this.
So I love this as well because I have been self-diagnosed for a decade. I finally got my diagnosis formally recently. And I've always practiced neurodiversity affirming ways in both fields, to the best of my ability, at least, because I started quite a while ago. I don't want to date myself. And I have not met many people that are both neurodivergent or BCBAs. Right? Or both, rather.
Yeah. No, I completely get that. It's the same exact way. I mean, being neurodivergent and a BCBA is very rare, especially, like, you know, I am going to date myself. I've been a BCBA for over 8 years, and there's been a lot of things that have happened in our field in the last 8-10 years, you know? So I can only imagine, you know, meeting other, like, neurodivergent people in our field. It's definitely rare these days.
Absolutely. I have found that there are more neurodivergent SLPs that I've come across than neurodivergent BCBAs.
Interesting. That's actually really interesting. Huh.
Yeah.
Wow. That's actually really interesting to know. I would have thought, if anything, there would be more neurodivergent BCBAs rather than neurodivergent, like, other medical providers that are neurodivergent too. So I don't know. I guess I just stick to ABA, I guess. I don't know.
Well, that's the beauty of having both degrees, because I always wanted to work with autistic folks. And so I got both degrees to be more well-rounded and then kind of shaped what I wanted to do from there.
Love it. I love that so much. Well, today's episode is all about Gestalt language processing, which, again, you know, I've mentioned, like, I'm more of a Gestalt language processor myself. And it's funny because I've worked with certain providers who are also SLPs and have mentioned that to me too. And it's like, this is really interesting. So for those who are not familiar with Gestalt language processing, can you give our listeners just a little bit of insight exactly what that is?
Of course. So we usually use the terms intonation babies for those who are speaking at a different kind of language processing, meaning they have long strings of intonation, long media clips, long songs, in my example, instead of having singular words, then two words, then three words, putting a sentence together. They have different ways of expressing themselves, which is not, by the way, lesser than. I want to make that extremely clear.
Yes.
But GLPs, Gestalt language processors, are those that look at language through lived experience. So these intonational chunks are meaningful in some way, shape, or form. And they kind of get, quote unquote, stuck in our brains. And it's due to an excited feeling or a sad feeling or a happy feeling or a depressing feeling. It could be a range of emotions. And that's why they get kind of, quote unquote, stuck in our brains. And they come out as long intonational trunks, media, etc. And we're able to, as we go on, quote unquote, mitigate is what it's called. So we take our chunks and we start to do things like mix and match. the chunks together. And then we get to a spot where maybe we're using a singular word. Or maybe we're using two words. Or maybe we've mitigated so much that we have flexible grammar. But there are multiple stages to gestalt language processing. They tend to be linear. However, some folks that have never worked with an SLP that is good at GLP work tend to mitigate themselves from what I've looked at with older generations that have never been diagnosed. And so in my particular instance, I was a GLP from birth, obviously. You're basically wired this way. And my first words, as my parents would say, was the Sesame Street theme song. So I'm singing it in my head right now and trying not to spit it out. Because that's just how I am. And so then my words were Big Bird, because that's what I associated with being excited. And eventually I got to things that interested me. So then the singular words started to come out. So that's just an example of how one GLP kind of works, but that was my experience. And it's very similar to those that have never had interventions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh my goodness. Well, that is really so awesome to even just like hear, you know, you mentioned GLPs come from lived experiences, at least yours did. And it's like, I can completely understand that. That being said, you mentioned you were recently diagnosed with autism officially, and you've been self-diagnosed for a long time. Could you share a little bit about how your recent diagnosis of autism and how your understanding of GLP has shaped your perspective on your own communication and language development?
Of course. I went to graduate school and was learning about autism because that's what they do. And I kept thinking to myself, wow, this sounds a lot like me. And I went to that professor and they were like, well, you wouldn't be here if you were autistic. And I shut that notion down that I would ever get a diagnosis, especially from my professor, who was running multiple trials on women, by the way, with the ADOS. And so I was extremely frustrated, left it on the back burner for a decade, and found this beautiful equine therapy place called Wilderwood. And they diagnosed 25 and older women specifically. Now, of course, most of the people that come through don't always get a diagnosis. However, they do a screening beforehand. And if you meet their research criterion, meaning that you scored on the CATQ, the RADS, the AQ, et cetera. And for those that don't know, these are screeners for autism and for girls with autism specifically sometimes. Then they proceed. And lo and behold, all my scores came back and they were like, we're ready to see what you got. And I went through 2 hours of assessments with this Equine Therapy Center virtually. And I was so relieved. I cried when they were like, Carly, you're autistic.
Aww.
And it made so much sense. And I felt so seen. I felt so seen and validated. And looking back, it just explains so much about my life. And looking back, I feel a little bit less nuts about some of the things that went down. I was like, oh, this makes sense now. And so with my language development, I was always sort of a quote unquote emotional child, as my parents would call it, right? So I was always singing a song. I was always very musically talented. My grandmother put me in lessons for voice at 5. So I was always singing, but it was quote unquote normalized. Right? So like, because I was in lessons, they're like, ah, she's just singing from lessons. But I was really singing for different emotional reasons. And so my first chunk was the Sesame Street theme song. Then it became, when I was 5, the Star Spangled Banner, because my grandmother would send out tapes of me singing the Star Spangled Banner to amateur baseball places, actually.
Oh my goodness.
She believed me that much. And she still
Oh.
does. She thinks I'm on Broadway or something, by the way.
Oh.
And so other chunks would just stick in music. And then they started to stick in media. And now, and we can talk a lot about this. I'm sure you can relate, but I will have, somebody will say one word and I will have a full conversation in my head loaded from TV, movies, mostly, or I'll have a lived experience that's stuck, that's associated with what they just said. Or sometimes I'm singing in my head and I have to, unless I feel safe and supported, I tend not to use those scripts. And it's very uncomfortable, honestly. It's very yeah. uncomfortable. And thank God, my scripts are mostly accepted this day and age because I am in SLP land mostly. I am an adjunct faculty at Towson and I'm teaching my students about GLPs. So when I script, I'll be like, oh, notice this. And they'll just be fascinated. And
it is really cool.
Yeah, yeah. So I play teacher. I'll be like, okay, get out your phones. Get on getyarn.io, which is the way that you can find media for a person's scripts. And I was like, all right, do your detective work. I'm not going to tell you. I'm going to play teacher here. And they'll find my media. And then I'm like, okay, how would you mitigate this? So it's a teachable moment. I get to use my scripts as a teachable moment, which is bizarre and wonderful at once.
So cool. That is so cool. You know, and it's so funny because, like, I can relate to a lot of what you're saying. You know, you mentioned your first words being, like, songs. Now, I don't know what my first words were, but I can tell you myself, I was very musically inclined when I was younger. Constantly learned by listening. I didn't need sheet music. I knew how to read music, but I could sing by ear. I could play flute by ear. I could play piano by ear. I could play violin by ear. I was very musically talented myself. So I understand exactly what you're saying. And, you know, you mentioned these scripts and how they're socially accepted. That's the same exact way for me. I mean, even as an autistic BCBA, somehow, some way, my scripts are somehow more accepted than I would think, which is so funny to even think about just because it's like, you know, some of what I say does come off as like, oh, this word, I can tell you about this experience, which I do a lot when I'm doing training, by the way. Don't know about you, but whenever I'm doing training with a BT or a trainee or a therapist, I will somehow find a way to put some sort of like relationship to what I'm saying. And it's a script, but it's accepted. So it's really cool to like be able to relate on that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I actually am training a BCBA to be right now. And we've been doing this for a very long time and she gets me completely. So I started to eventually script in front of her. And I use it in my training as a BCBA as well. So I get exactly what you're saying. So we were talking about stimulus equivalence. And the way that I learned it was bizarre in my head. But she just got it from my script.
That's awesome. That is so awesome. Oh my gosh. Don't you love how, like, you know, it may seem quote unquote odd for other people. But like for people like us who, you know, are neurodivergent, who learn differently, it's amazing how we can take these relationships and they're still okay and they're still correct and they're still valid. You know, it's amazing to me. Ugh.
Absolutely. And I love when I do feel safe and supported, which is honestly often these days that I don't suppress my scripts. I essentially just will spit something out and somebody will spit something back out at me.
I love that.
Right? So we're just exchanging media.
Exactly. That's what it's all about, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So my boyfriend right now, he knows exactly what I'm saying from the exact media, 90% of the time. So he'll finish my quotes.
That's so cool. I love that so much. Oh, I love that so much. And, you know, it's so funny. It's so funny because, like, some people will be like, wait a minute, like, what are you talking about? But then once you realize, once they understand, it's like, oh, okay, now I get it. Now I can understand where you're coming from.
Yeah. Oh, it's a magical thing.
It's really quite magical. You know, and going back to scripts too. So one of the things that you mentioned was that your first song or your first words were a song, and that your language development involved these like scripts and these different melodies too. Tell us a little bit more about your childhood experiences with language and how GLP relates to those early forms of communication too.
So there's also something called Gestalt cognitive processing that I would kind of like to delve into a little bit.
Yeah.
So Gestalt cognitive processing is the way in which one experiences something and then has a routine around it. So the way that I sort of developed a sense of safety was when if I had even a negative experience, I would sing a song to transition in my head. So there were certain like safe things for me that I would be able to kind of regulate myself with, because a Gestalt cognitive processor basically has those stuck experiences and they have to create a routine then around that particular experience. Just like it would be an emotional heightened script, it's an emotional heightened experience. And again, it can be excited, it can be scary, it can be anything. So the way that I sort of developed things were like things I found that gave me comfort. Because I won't lie, my childhood was very chaotic. I was raised mostly by my grandmother and grandfather. And they fostered my abilities very quickly, which was beautiful. So they saw me singing. So my grandmother would put me on tape.
Aww.
Singing. And they would see me being interested in books. So I was hyperlexic. So I was reading chapter books by five, you know, because they would foster my reading abilities. So I would take my positive associations of comfort with them when I would have to go back to mom and dad, right? Because they didn't have guardianship over me. Yeah. Mm. So, and that was rough. That was really rough.
Yeah.
So I would often to transition, I would sing something to myself in the car. Or if my abilities weren't fostered, I would often blurt things out at home and they would be like, we don't know what you're talking about. Yeah. And so they have a different experience of what quote unquote my first words were. And they thought it was hilarious. Because I did not quote unquote speak until they can't remember what age.
Wow.
And yeah. And so when I first started putting words kind of like sort of together, I would have a belly laugh in between. Big bird. Ball. Bucket. Notice they're all B words. Notice they're probably from Sesame Street.
Exactly.
So they recorded me doing that. And they thought it was just the funniest thing. And I was like thinking to myself, huh, this has a pattern, an intonation, a rhythm. It's not a singular word.
Right.
And I give it a song-like quality. Yeah, so they're thinking I'm saying one word at a time and have a belly laugh in between, but I'm having a rhythm. This is a game to me. This is a process. Yeah.
So interesting. So interesting. You know, you mentioned like, you know, them recording and, you know, like how your parents might have had different experiences from what your first words were. I had kind of like I had a childhood where I had an amazing mom. You know, she was 100% supportive, but my dad did not understand autism at all. You know, my dad, I'm pretty sure my dad has a few other behavioral like disorders. Like, I jury's out, but I'm pretty sure he has narcissistic personality disorder, just to give you an idea. And his comparison of autism for me was as if I was Rain Man, which I'm just like, that's your, the only reason why I laugh at that is because that is his only connection to autism is Rain Man. He doesn't realize that autism is literally like, it's so beyond the scope of what we think it is. So it's really interesting hearing about your childhood because I can relate in some capacity of like, you know, your parents have this different understanding. And then also too, you mentioned being recorded. I remember personally, I had a day where I was scripting and I was in the shower and I had a roommate at the time and she recorded me scripting. Like audio recorded me scripting as a way to make fun of me to other people. And it's like, you know, have you had experiences like that before where like somebody's tried to do that to you?
Often.
Awful, right?
Often. Yeah. So I was bullied a lot as a kid, and that's a lot of what I wrote for my narrative for Wilderwood, is that I've been othered consistently, and it kind of makes a lot of sense because there aren't many of us out there that were diagnosed, right? And so we were just these aliens.
Yes.
You know, nobody knew how to quote unquote handle us. We
Yeah,
didn't
very
know
that.
then. So I actually was very much othered, except for one of my oldest and best friends. And I was exposed to Saturday Night Live at a very early age, 7, in fact. So I would script with her, Mary Catherine Gallagher. And Night of the Roxbury, and pretty much anything SNL in the 90s.
Love it.
And she would just get it, and we'd be like dancing and singing, and like people thought we were nuts. And we were always bullied. Always bullied. And they would make fun of us doing pretty much anything at that point, whether it was quote unquote normal or not. Because we had this connection that people didn't understand.
Yeah, I mean, I can completely understand that too, because it's like, you know, even experiences that I've had where I found something really funny, either it can be from TV or it can be even like somebody saying something funny. You know, you almost like hold on to that. But then because of the bullying, you almost have to suppress yourself from actually saying it because what's the chance of you getting bullied again? You know, it's awful. Ugh.
I just find, you know, I'm 36 now, and I find myself really developing into the human that I always wish I had as a little girl. I think a lot of us can relate to that. And what I really love is that the people that I surround myself with accept me fully. And I make sure that the people I surround myself with accept me fully. My employment, my friends, my romantic relationships, all of them matter so much to me that I have, and I disclose my autism immediately with my employment, my doctoral program, everything, so that they not only understand me, because it doesn't quote unquote excuse my behavior, but they can be like, oh, okay, so she scripts.
Yeah.
Okay, so she likes routine. Okay, so she might have some quirky qualities. You
Yes.
know?
I 100% get that. In my case, it's she likes to have things in a certain way. She likes to have visual instructions and not just be told, hey, do this, do that, do the other thing. She loves deadlines. I used to be a journalism major. I used to do journalism before BCBA life. So deadlines were like a major thing for me. And if something didn't happen the way, I don't know about you, but my inflexibility was it was and still is high to this day, because it's like, but you guys have said to do this this way, and now suddenly you want to do it a completely different way. What's happening here? You know, the inflexibility is like, it's happening because you guys aren't communicating these things. And it's funny because, yes, I do that a lot, but I see other people understand why and also do that too. And they're not autistic. They're not neurodivergent. So it's like, you get me. You really get me.
Yes, yes. So it's wild working at a university because everything is loosey-goosey, but I set my own deadlines.
Oh, man.
And the students come to me and they're like, okay, Professor Donnelly, like, when do you want my SOAP note in? And I'll be really explicit. I'll give them an exact minute that they need it in by. You know, because I'm like, I'm not given any wiggle room.
Yeah. No, you shouldn't.
Yeah, it's just, honestly, it makes me feel comfy.
Understandable. Mm-hmm. You know, so kind of going back to, like, the scripts and stuff, you know, we talked about, you know, scripts sort of, like, being in our head, and you ended up, like, stopping yourself from using those in public, because I would imagine probably due to, like, the bullying and stuff that you faced growing up. And I completely get that. I'm right there with you. How does that experience reflect the cognitive processing associated with gestalt language processing?
So I kind of go back to 7-year-old Carly again whenever I have to suppress my scripts. I mean, I had so many slurs that were thrown my way, and I won't even repeat them. That's how low they were because of, like, how I functioned as a human being. That was very natural to me. So I often will honestly have negative experiences when I have to suppress my scripts. So the cognitive part of this is that I will have the slurs in my head while I'm suppressing my scripts.
Yeah.
And I physically hurt. I physically hurt too. I will clench my neck. It's kind of when I stop my stims too. It's very similar.
Yeah.
It's very similar. Or when I have to mask for long periods of time, like, I will physically hurt. So I worked on that with somebody, as I call her, my autism doctor. She's somebody who specializes in autism, LGBTQ plus people, women. So, like, all me, and it's beautiful. And she taught me how to unmask, and I literally felt, like, looser. When she taught me what the gestalt cognitive processes that I actually had were, which were these slurs in my head, she was like, we can release those. We can create a new routine. Right? That's how you get the cognitive processing to kind of shift. So I think of the things that comfort me in order to shift my cognitive processing. So I will often, if you hear me singing, "Hey, yeah," it's in what I'm playing in my head is the Peanuts dancing to "Hey, yeah."
I love that. I love that so much. I actually know the exact video, and you may not see it, but as you, like, say that, I'm actually imagining that video clip. And imagining the audio. I love that.
So in my head, I'm comforting myself to a neutral experience because that's really what kind of got me there.
Yeah.
You know, that's how I transitioned from a negative slur space to a neutral experience is by singing "Hey" on my head and knowing exactly what I'm seeing.
Oh my goodness. See, and that's why, like, we as BCBAs really need to create more safe spaces for our clients. Safe space, ironic. You know, so we need to create those safe spaces so that way we're not inadvertently causing harm, you know, because suppressing those scripts and suppressing, you know, what's going through your head can ultimately, I mean, you mentioned physical pain. That is harm. That's in our ethics code. We do no harm, you know, like, how can we try to stop those things from happening and be okay with the potential fact of someone being physically hurt as a result.
Mm-hmm. So, excuse me. The thing that I've come to really realize when I collaborate as an SLP and also with this privilege of being a BCBA as well, is that I will straight up say verbal behavior is not the way to teach language. It is not. I will say that outright. I do not really believe that man's toxic coex, et cetera, are the way to teach language. Because something that might be a man to one individual might be a tack to a consult language processor. You don't know.
That's actually a really interesting perspective. I'm really intrigued.
So because of the way that we process language, a lot of the times I see BCBAs being like, oh yeah, we have to man first. Because requesting is very important. However, I am tacting in my head oftentimes when I have particular gestalt cognitive experiences. I label something with an emotion that I'm feeling. And by the way, I do not believe in labeling feelings, right? Like, I am anxious. I am sad. Like, no, that's not how it works for an autistic person a lot of the time.
Yeah.
You know, so I just want to put that out there. And the processing that goes around an emotional experience, whether it's you can put your finger on the feeling or not, is such that, say I just had this example with my boyfriend. He said crack because I have a two double bed and there's a crack in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And I immediately tacted in my head something very different, which is a Mean Girls quote, crack.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about too.
Yes. Yes. And people can interpret that different ways. Yeah. Me saying crack after them, they probably think it's an anechoic.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then I'm speaking nonsense, but no, I'm tacting something very real to me.
Yeah.
So that's why I believe that verbal behavior is broken for a lot of our autistic folks.
Yeah. I can see why. I mean, like, I'm thinking a lot about, like, my own practice, and I'm used to, like, following what ABA is, like, expecting us to do, but not really thinking so much, like, outside of that, necessarily. You know, you mentioned the labeling feelings thing. I have clients and technicians, and even technicians who will be like, so my friends don't know how to label their feelings. And it's like, I mean, it's tough to teach that. But then at the same time, it's like, how can we sit there and, you know, expect them to necessarily like say, this is how you feel, you know? Or like, yeah. My least favorite program is the big problem, small problem program these days. Yeah.
You guys can't see this, but I had a visceral reaction to that.
Very that. And it's so funny because, you know, there are some people who insist on that program, on working on that, but it's like, dude, you don't know what a big problem is to this person. You don't know what a small problem is to this person. You don't know what what that person might think is a big problem to them might be a small problem to you, but that doesn't mean that they're wrong in that sense. Why do they think, why don't you think about why they think it's a big problem rather than, oh, it's not a big problem. You don't need an adult. You don't need to call 911. Like, but yeah. What?
Yeah, oh. I agree. And expected, unexpected is language that I just can't get on board with.
Yeah.
And yeah. That's the same program.
Yeah, that's true. That is exactly true. Again, what is expected to you might be unexpected to them, and what is unexpected to us might be expected for them. So it's like, again, think about it. Mm-hmm. It's so hilarious how we as BCBAs have to teach perspective taking, and yet, you know, our autistic learners are expected to pick up on our perspectives, but how come we're not picking up on our autistic learners? Like,
agreed. Agreed.
What?
Again. Does not compute.
Yeah, exactly. For those of you, because, you know, of course we release audio. If you could just see my hands, they're going all over the place because I'm like, what? Oh my God. I can only imagine. Oh, I'm so curious to know too. So as both a BCBA and someone who identifies as being neurodivergent, and of course, you know, from self-diagnosis and from formal diagnosis as well, what challenges have you faced with aligning ABA practices with a neurodiversity affirming approach, particularly when it comes to GLP?
I have had, believe it or not, more headway with new BCBAs than I have with some older SLPs.
You know, I can actually see that, but I'm curious to know a little bit more.
Yeah, so I had this particular case that I worked with for 5 years, and my learner was absolutely a GLP from day one, and I knew it.
Okay.
Knew it. And I was trying to make him more understood to listeners and have people kind of get on board with repeating his scripts back to him and acknowledging them and all that so that we could maybe understood where they came from, because getyarn.io did not exist back then. I had to do my detective work.
Oh.
Yes, much harder. Much harder. So I would try to get language samples from everybody so that I could better understand when he was using certain gestalts and how. And the SLP was straight up telling me, nope, too much work. I would give her a Google document that was de-identified, and she still wouldn't do it.
Wow.
Yeah. And I gave her every opportunity in every single way. I'd be like, okay, take it for, you know, we tell them, like, taking data all day, every day is not the way to go. It's not sustainable, especially in parent training. And I told her, like, take 30 minutes of data just during your sessions. I would give her something manageable, chunked down. And she was still resistant. So, and then I went to a BCBA that was not an SLP, had no idea what a GLP was, and they were young and fresh, and they were willing to learn. And so they said to me, yeah, I'll take language samples. Yeah, I'll learn about this. Yeah, I'll take Alexandria Zappos' course. And they were all on board. The entire center got on board with me.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's because, honestly, and we'll get, I think we wanted to get to this anyway, so I'm going to skip to the good part. I honestly think it has a lot to do with the fact that BCBAs are so stuck on randomized controlled trials as the only part of evidence-based practice.
Yes.
Especially if you're old school. When really the triangle is very clear, and the triangle is just a very basic version of EBP. Client like perspectives is part of that.
Yeah.
So by lived experience alone, that should be enough for us as BCBAs to say, oh yeah, this is valid. But the old school BCBAs are saying, well, there's not enough evidence because there's not a randomized controlled trial. Well, this has been around since the 70s, honey bunches of oats. Like, let's be real. Barry Prezant was cranking out those articles back then.
Mm-hmm.
And no, they were not randomized controlled trials, but they were articles and they were published and they were evidence-based. This is not something that's any newer than what, our field?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's why it's wild to me. It's wild to me.
It's so interesting because, yeah, I mean, the reason why I said I wasn't too surprised about the old school SLP was because I had speech and language growing up, too. And I had one particular SLP that my mom hated, by the way. My mom hated her. She fired her really quick. And my mom was like, you know, oh, what are some things that you've been working on? I'm curious to know. And she goes, I don't work on any, I don't take data, I don't do this. She doesn't track my progress at all. And then my mom was like, oh, you know, do you have any like continuing education under your belt? You know, because my mom my mom really wants to know like a little bit more about the SLP's practice. And she's like, I don't need continuing education. So that's where that, yeah.
Listeners, you guys can't see, but I have a gate mouth.
Yes, listeners, if you could only see. It was kind of shocking and also kind of like, really? Like, how could you even like say that, you know? Even if you don't agree with, you know, the randomized control trials or, you know, no matter what, you should still be getting continuing education. So the fact that this SLP had the gall to say that, I mean, my mom fired her like the next day, but it's still like, what the actual?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, by the way, a violation of our ethics.
Bury that. Bury that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Without continuing education, you know what happens? You can lose your license.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Ashley can hunt you down.
Bury that. Bury that. On the note of continuing education, let's go ahead and toss that first code word in. That first code word is sesame, like Sesame Street, like we were talking about earlier. So sesame is spelled S-E-S-A-M-E, sesame, think Sesame Street. Oh, my goodness. Oh, so talking a little bit about Marge Blanc and Alexandria Zakos. You mentioned, you know, the work of them. They've conducted significant research on GLP and natural language acquisition. How do their findings challenge traditional views of language development within applied behavior analysis?
Well, they are not fans of ABA, I will tell you that much, because a lot of what ABA does is it puts GLPs in a box. It makes us believe that they must process language at a rate that the VV map determines. Because, well, let's be real, a lot of us were taught to check boxes on the VV map as we're no matter what age the person is, while we're assessing.
Yeah.
And a lot of what we have is rote language. I want this. I need that. You know, so we have sentence starters. We have visuals. We have visual schedules. We have, you know, timers, we have stopwatches, we have, like, it's so putting autistic folks and especially GLPs in a box.
Yeah.
It's very detrimental. Unless you come across one of us who knows the autistic experience, right? And Marge Blanc and Alexandria Zakos, you know, they've interacted with me. They know that I'm a BCBA. And they respect what I do, and they often say things like, how can you be in this field? And it's because I'm a change maker that I'm able to kind of be respected, because I'm open-minded, I pivot, I turn, I am consistently learning and unlearning, I accept when I'm wrong, you know, I'm not going to say I'm right about everything. And Alexandria Zakos and Marge Blanc are teaching a lot right now about how to be best child-led for Gestalt language processors, because they have such high emotional experiences. And some Gestalts, by the way, that we model might not work. They might not work. They might not click with that child. So we have to always be looking at what matters to the child we're interacting with, the learner we're interacting with at every single moment. We have to be on our detective game. We have to be on our language game with both language sampling and realizing what works and what doesn't. And also, they both talk a lot about play-based learning.
Which I love, by the way.
Me too. I love being a kid 24/7.
Same.
That's why I love my work so much. And so having a variety of things available for the child to pivot to and from in their own way, not a forced choice, not a field of three, none of that.
No.
Is so important for a GLP to develop.
Yeah. I mean, I can tell you right now, I'm a BCBA that looks at what matters to them should be what's targeted for them. You know, if, for example, I have a three-year-old and they really love, let's say they really love the wheels on the bus, right? And they know how to fill in those phrases and they know how to sing that song, then that's something that I'm going to take very seriously. But if I throw in a brand new song that they absolutely hate, like I know I have a lot of kids who hate the Happy Birthday song, I'm not going to touch that. Why? Because number one, chances are they are going to end up absolutely hating me as a result of constantly having to work on Happy Birthday to you, you know, they're going to hate working on it. And number two, for them in that moment, it doesn't matter to them. It's not, as we say in ABA, socially significant to them in that moment, you know? Mm-hmm. So I appreciate that so much because again, I'm the same exact way. What matters to the child is what matters to the child. Stop looking at what matters to us, you know?
Yes. Amen to that.
Love. You know, and it's so interesting too, because again, like you also mentioned like the checking of the boxes. If there's something that I tell my candidates that I supervise, and if there's anything that I just say in general, assessments are a guide. They are not your end all be all. And I think BCBAs in particular get caught up in this idea that you have to check a box. And if they don't check the box and they're not going to get discharged from ABA services, they're going to be an ABA forever. And that's not it. That's not it. You know, like, why does this little box, why is it that this one white colored box has to be filled in? Chances are, it doesn't matter to them. Like, it's amazing. It's amazing that there are people who still think like that. Ugh.
I know. And it's a tricky line with insurance.
Right.
You know? So, like, this is a funny story that I'll just quickly put out there. I once wrote such a strengths-based report that they were like, why is this kid getting services? Yeah.
Insurance. Wow.
I had to rewrite the report and be like, yeah, your kid's a monster. Sorry. You know, like there was no in between. Like, I have to be deficits based essentially to get these reports written. And I will always caveat this with, don't read my report. Take my word.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, because I'm not private pay for BCBA. I'm not. I'm insurance based. So you got to do what you got to do, unfortunately. And so you write these reports that are icky. But again, like, I don't check a box ever. I ask the parent what they want. I look at the child. I'm like, what do they really care about? I think about, you know, the ways to lead them forward by using their interests and their repetitive and restrictive behaviors and like the things that make them comfy.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. If you're not looking at the child, then what are you doing?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Unfortunately, it's a fight that we have to fight with insurance about maybe changing their minds on, you know, making it not so much deficit-based and not so much DSM criteria and, like, all of those things, you know. We've got to look at it from a different perspective. That I feel like is a fight with insurance in of itself.
And absolutely. The DSM is made by old white men and it's pathologizing. And what I love about my specific report when I was diagnosed was that it was so well written that I did not feel pathologized in any way, shape, or form. It was objective observations as well as test scores that made sense to me about me.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I was diagnosed with autism when I was 3 years old. So I'm considered one of the rare types because, you know, girls and autism, that we go undetected. But my mom was like, there is something very off about you. We are getting you diagnosed. And I happened to look at that report from 20 years ago. And I looked at certain things and it was like, it was kind of interesting reading the report. Does it make 100% sense to me? No. But there were certain things that stuck out to me, like little details will always stick out to me. Like there was one line that said, and I kid you not, that I ate shampoo. And I remember reading that and just laughing hysterically because I don't eat shampoo now, just so you know, listeners and BCBA candidates that I supervise. I don't eat shampoo, but it's like, it's so funny to read things like that because it's like, holy moly, like, what kind of child was I back then?
I had a lot of weird, quirky things as well that make a lot of sense now, looking back at it. Like, I remember while everybody else was having, like, Barbie parties and things like that, I was, like, playing with little monsters in my corner.
Oh, my God. For me, it was shaving the, or not shaving, it was cutting the heads of Barbies and cutting yep. their hair and then generalizing it over to myself.
Oh, I cut my own hair more times than I would like to admit.
Yes.
Yeah, my mom loved that.
Oh, yeah. Same. What I loved was having to get my head shaved in first grade. That was where it was at. It's like, oh my God.
Oh, the special memories of being autistic.
The special autistic journeys, I swear, right? Well, even with, you know, the autistic journey, you know, some argue that certain ABA practices can feel like an assault to the mind. And I say that in quotations because, you know, some people really do feel that way. There are some people who don't feel that way, especially for those who process language just gesturally or gesturally, basically. So can you elaborate on this sentiment and discuss how ABA can be better adapted to support gestalt processors?
Sure. I would say that they should be looking, BCBAs in general should be looking at how a child develops, not from a word, a man attacked in a coic at a time, and increasing vocabulary. It should be about meeting the learner where they're at with their processing. So looking at if they're doing long intonational chunks or even infants babbling a certain way. Right? Because like even really young kids, like I was 10 months when I started singing, you know? Yeah. So like it came really early for me. And at that point, you got to say to yourself, BCBA out there, maybe she's a GLP. So we shouldn't be giving her just vocabulary word after vocabulary word after vocabulary word that you're ticking off on a box, you know? And you think you know what this child needs, because it's going to, quote unquote, meet a requirement, right? So she has 50 mans. Super. Do they mean anything to her? Probably not. You know? So we have to think about that. We also have to think about how GLPs go from a much larger sense of the world and that, like, media and strong emotions and strong, I guess, like, experiences push things forward.
Right.
So we have to realize, like, kind of where they're coming from, how we can best support the learner by acknowledging how to mitigate those groups, which means that we mix and match what they have already in the beginning stages. What vocabulary they already have in use to then push them forward. We don't want new things necessarily, especially in the beginning phases. We need to think about leading the child, learner, et cetera, in a way that makes sense, not just word by word.
Yeah.
Because if you're doing that, you're doing a disservice.
Yeah.
And I honestly say that for all ABA practices, not just GLPs. Because the sentence strips, I'm over it. You know, that's giving kids rote language that they're going to get stuck. I always teach people that my autistic folks, when they learn I want, it's probably one word to them.
Yeah.
It's probably one word to them. So I never teach I want or the sign language for more first. Because they're going to come up to you being like, more what?
Yeah, that's more true. Right.
Teaching baby sign is great, but if you teach more first instead of like again or, you know, mans that make sense for a baby that, you know, is typically developing, then like, what are we doing?
Yeah, that is true. And language has to matter.
Yes, all forms of language.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I completely agree. I mean, I can understand too, because like I am somebody who has taught those like sentence starters. I'm somebody who has done that. And you know, again, I'm thinking of it as like maybe it will come along. Maybe it does make sense to them. And in some cases, yes, it does. But if you're not focusing on what language, you know, how this language is going to impact them positively, what are we doing? And why are we doing it?
Exactly. Exactly.
So, how do you see the future of GLP being integrated in ABA frameworks, especially in a way that respects and supports neurodiversity?
I think that we need to start with using different ways to assess our learners. I think language samples are key. Coding language samples by stages are key, which, by the way, is not easy. It takes a lot of practice. It takes a lot of expertise. So, if anything, I would say be doing it regularly for all your learners.
Yeah.
You know, coding language in general is very, very, very important. Know exactly where your learner is processing. Write goals that make sense to them. So I write goals that say we'll use 10 new mitigable gestalts. That could mean, and that has been taken by insurance, by the way.
Really?
Yes.
Interesting.
So we're just looking at like what's coming out of their mouth that's new. And if they reach 10 over, and I don't do 3 consecutive sessions, by the way, I think that's a load. I do within 6 out of 10 sessions over 10 weeks, right? Because that's a way more manageable.
Yeah, I could see that actually. Now that, especially when it comes to communication, you know.
Yes. And that's how I start out with my gestalt language processors. And honestly, that's pretty easy for any BCBA to pick up. Are they using new language or not?
Yeah, exactly.
And then when it gets to the nitty-gritty, when the child starts developing different stages, we need to be picking up on when they do. And mixing and matching their media when they first start to learn, and getting down to those two-word, one-word utterances when they start to get to stage 3, and when they get to stage 4 and start to develop grammar, not correcting their grammar necessarily, but letting them kind of flow and realizing that the sentences might sound awkward, but that's okay. Not forcing any sort of language on them. Pronouns are really hard. IU is really hard. You know, and I think IU is really hard for probably any child. We don't need to be forcing that on a GLP in stage 4. I think that recognizing how everything sort of works for a GLP is really, really difficult, but it's really, really good work. Because there, yes, 80% of GLPs are autistic, and not 80% of autistic people are GLPs. There's a correlation, not a causation. But we are doing a disservice to our GLPs by not learning about it because a
Yeah.
lot of them are autistic.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go. There you go. I mean, it's pretty amazing, you know. It's one of those things where you do have to, you know, we talk about the word pivot. You got to pivot. You know, it's not just about doing what's based on the ABLES or the AFLs or whatever assessment you're doing for insurance. You have to actually like make the effort in trying to see what their language is, where they are, how you can meet them, and how you can work on even expanding that. Of course, meeting them where they are, but then expand it in the way that means most to them. That's kind of what I'm getting.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's I could go into the intimate details of what each stage is, but I think that people should really do their research, you know? I think that you should learn about each stage and coding and things like that in a way that makes sense. So I highly recommend following Alexandria Zachos and looking at her videos because that's a
Yeah.
great teachable moment for everybody that wants to know about GLPs. Boho Speechy, Katya. She's also great. She's got a lot of videos for each stage. So I recommend following them, and that way you're learning by doing in a lot of
Yeah.
ways.
That's awesome. I will have to look them up on Instagram as soon as we get off. I will say, as soon as we sign up, I will definitely be looking them up. So, because I'm very interested. And I want to go ahead and throw our second code word. Our second code word is a word we've been talking about, mitigation. That is MITIGATION, mitigation. So, kind of on an ending note, what advice would you give to other BCBAs who are neurodivergent or maybe even not neurodivergent, actually, but are trying to become more neurodiversity affirming in their practice, especially when it comes to recognizing and supporting different language processing styles like GLP?
Listen to autistic voices first.
Yeah.
Step one, right? Because the things that we learn in class are often false and they're outdated too. I remember that when I was becoming a BCBA, I challenged the professor. I said, "This book is 10 years old and from Britain about the autistic population. How could it possibly be relevant to me today?" And I started to listen to autistic voices just on Instagram, on YouTube, on because we didn't really have the doom scroll back when I was becoming a BCBA. So I had to really, really search. But no, listen to autistic voices first. And challenge your previously conceived notions about what's quote unquote right. I think that evidence-based practice is a lot about the client experience. And if we aren't continuing to take the client perspective into account, then we're doing a disservice to ourselves and to others. I think that essentially, if we don't start there and we don't start learning about gestalt language processing as well with the client perspective in at hand, then we're doing a disservice to our clients. I urge BCBAs to really have an open mind, listen to some SLPs that are fresh-faced, and really know that like this is a steep learning curve. You're not going to get it right all the time. It may be intimidating and it may be something that seems out of our scope of practice, but it really isn't because it is evidence-based practice. It might be scary and new, and it's our duty to know.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like no matter what, you should be listening to autistic voices first and foremost, even if no matter what type of language processor they are,
Yes.
no matter what, because this is their experience. We're there to support, we're a temporary part of their lives, but ultimately, we need to listen to our clients first, because this is their life that we are ultimately impacting in some, hopefully, in a more positive way. But this is their lives at the end of the day. We are helping our clients to make to live their best life. This shouldn't all be on us as the BCBA. And yes, everybody, believe it or not, the BCBA is not always right. Please humble yourself. I say that all the time, but it's so true. It's like, guys, come on.
That's true.
Oh my goodness. Carly, I have loved this conversation with you. I am just so I'm so amped up. Like, it makes me so
Me
happy
too.
that we get to talk about this. And I'm really, really thankful that you came onto the podcast today. So, on a final note, where can our listeners find you? How can they get in touch with you?
So, I'll be very honest, my socials are lacking right now. However, if you do want to message me, I'm at CDONN88, like the first initial of my name, the last or the first four letters of my last name, and the year 88 on Instagram. I will be happy to field any questions as I feel that it's kind of my duty to disseminate. But I will tell you right now, I'm mostly singing and dancing on
Wow.
there.
I love it. I love it. Well, thank you so much, Carly. I'm so happy you came onto the podcast. And thank you, everyone, for listening to today's podcast episode. I hope you have a good rest of your day. I've been your host, Michelle Zeman, and I'll see you on the next one. Bye.